ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Coming up, I go wading through chilly waters in search of some 3D printed marine technology. I talk with Paul Bangay on the other leaves in his life, his garden books, and we journey to Auckland in search of disaster resilience. Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green with Places, Spaces, Food, Gardens and Design, some of it submersible. Amazing shapes lapped by waves on a cold southern foreshore shortly. And to round it all off, Colin Bissett will crane his neck, the better to take in the work of Cesar Pelli. That sound you hear, that splishing and sploshing, that's me wading in the rather chilly waters of Port Phillip, just near the heads into Bass Strait. It's the beautiful city of Greater Geelong. And over there, poking up just below the surface and just above it like some set of alien creatures. Well, it's not that. It's a wave break installed by some very clever and creative people. It's a new approach to coastal defence. I'm almost with them. They are going to tell me all about it.
Hey there.
I'm Alex. Nice to meet you.
Hi.
Thanks for coming down.
What beautiful noises this is making.
Not really.
So tell me where we are.
So this is Clifton Springs. So this is called the Dell. So we've actually got Ralph here from Geelong City Council as well, who sort of lives locally, and these are his daughters. So this is Becky as well from the University of Melbourne. Guys,
hello.
Jonathan.
Hi, Jonathan.
Ralph and Becky.
Jonathan. How do you do?
Hi, nice to meet you.
Well, what a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Great project, Ralph.
Oh, it's a wonderful place, the Dell. The Dell's very popular with locals and visitors.
What was the problem you were trying to fix?
We've noticed over through a review of historic aerial imagery, the narrowing and reduction of the width of the beach. We believe that there could be anecdotally, there's evidence that there was a lot of shell extraction from the beach in as far back as the 1930s, and that may have made the whole the beach environment less stable.
Shell extraction, that's not just people picking them up?
No, on an industrial scale. Right. So shell was bagged up, taken away for various uses, yep. But basically the carbonate in the shell has many, many different uses.
And you're trying to, with this reef, I guess, stabilise the erosion that you've been seeing along the foreshore?
Well, that's the downstream effect. The reef is really just primarily to reduce wave energy and wave height, and that has a flow-on effect in terms of stabilising the beach, and it has creates a, if you like, a wave shadow where suspended sediment that moves up and down the coast can actually settle out and increase the amount of sand on the beach and thereby broadening the beach.
Good outcome. Is this something of a trial? I mean, this is a long stretch of coast here which must have similar issues.
There are similar issues. We trialled another reef about 10 kilometres away from here up near Port Arlington 5 years ago it was installed, and that's performed very, very well in terms of broadening the beach. There's a lot more sand on the beach in the lee of the reef. It has been, these techniques have been used right around the world in various degrees of success. So we're not
reinventing the wheel.
Not reinventing the wheel. We're borrowing from the learnings of other such.
But you're making some pretty cool stuff.
That's not me. That's more so Alex and his wonderful designs. And we gave him a very broad brief in terms of just a basic size, height,
yep.
and wanted Alex to come back with something that was, I guess, sympathetic to the marine environment.
So that brief in size and height, that's determined by the outcomes you...
Determined by, yes, the amount of bulk we wanted to introduce into the shallow near shore water to reduce wave height. But colleagues of Becky through the University of Melbourne and University of Western Australia did some modelling on the shape, size, the bulk of the reef to see, to have a look at and actually quantify the effect of the wave reduction.
Is it reproducing a pre-existing structure out here? Were there earlier reefs of this type?
Probably not in terms of rocky reefs, but we understand that there was a quite broad areas of shellfish reef.
Okay.
Throughout Port Phillip Bay, that has since
been barrier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So part of the research that Becky's doing through or with the University of Melbourne is to look at ways that or those types of shellfish reef could be reintroduced.
Okay.
And that's probably more typical to the other reef that we installed so 5 years ago.
Different style of structure.
Totally different. Yeah.
Let's go and have a look. Wow. They are wonderful shapes. What's the Becky, what's the material?
I think you should ask Alex. Yeah.
Okay. Gather around everybody. Describe this for me, Alex.
Yeah, so we've used, this is like a marine concrete, and the way that we molded these, we used a digital manufacturing process to create a 3D printed mold, essentially. And we've been able to use traditional precasting techniques to produce these shapes. So, I mean, our studio really looks at how we can optimize the design to create things like rock pools and various kind of crevices for the different species that we get here to colonize. But we've also looked at, you know, how we can reduce the amount of material and also still maintain the bulk that's needed for the wave attenuation.
I mean, the shape is broadly circular. There's a large base. It's probably, a couple of metres in diameter, and that rises to this little dome.
Yeah, exactly. So we needed that width to make sure the units were stable, so we get that 1-in-50-year storm. They're not going to sort of shift around.
What's the weight of each of them?
Each one's about 1.8 tonne.
Okay, it should stay there.
I think it'll be fine. We've also we've had the units actually stabilised to the ground using some manta ray anchor systems.
Not taking any chances there.
But the design is really also there's been created this way so that people can snorkel around the units. So traditional wave breaks are really very flat and they're not that porous.
But these pods are staggered, aren't they?
Exactly.
There's space between them.
And that's so people can come down here and snorkel. So I think we're really interested in how, you know, you can get these multi-use, multi-benefits with these bits of essential infrastructure.
We're here at pretty low tide. A high tide there, how far under the water?
Yeah, so I think high tide comes up to about here. So you can really snorkel around them at high tide.
That would cover them by the best part of a metre of water.
Yeah, exactly. So, coming down here at high tide, we've sort of created this bit of like essential infrastructure to attenuate waves and also a snorkeling destination. So,
nice.
You know, I think that's what we should start do with all our marine infrastructure, to build in this habitat and build in interesting niches for people to come and snorkel.
How long have they been in?
So these have been in now for about 4 or 5 months now.
September 26th.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they've settled in, aren't they?
They're covered in weed
and little shellfish. I mean, they're becoming part of the environment.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we want. You know, we want these to really start to fuse into the environment, so they don't look. I think they're always going to look man-made, and we're not designing them to.
But they look man-made in a really good way.
Yeah, well, exactly. I think, you know, if they're going to be, you know, man-made, we need to do it in a way that they fuse into the environment as much as possible.
Well, and I've seen, similar sort of projects like this. I mean, not similar, probably, but you see, you know, jumbles of rock or concrete lumps sort of in mounds and piles, groins of them out to sea.
Yeah, and I mean,
which is less appealing.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, a really effective sort of way of engineering the coast. But I think, especially if you're going to use concrete, concrete is a liquid material before it sets, so why not create, you know, these fascinating shapes that have multiple benefits.
And, for those who don't know your work, you've been doing this with 3D printing in various materials in all sorts of marine environments for all sorts of uses.
Yeah, so we've been doing a bit of work with coral gardening. We're part of the Living Seawalls team, which is very similar to this.
Kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, working with all kinds of marine infrastructure. Yeah, we're working on another project with Becky to do with coastal defence. So, yeah, there's so many interesting opportunities in this area, and we're trying to bring design to it, basically.
They're very cool. I'm finding it hard to describe them.
Glad you finally come down here.
Well, yeah. Has it taken a while?
No. They'll be here for the next, 10, 20, 30 years.
How long do they last? What's your...
Well, I mean, look, we've designed these to have a minimum life of 30 years. But I think one of the advantages of the way that we designed them is we used stainless steel 316 lifting lugs. So these could always be shifted in the future if need be, it was deemed that, another area was more important to be protected or if they needed to be removed for whatever reason.
So how many of them here?
So we've installed 47 here.
Is there a particular pattern?
Well, yeah, so Ralph was in charge of creating the pattern. And
what do you call the pattern, Ralph? It's like a bit of a serpentine.
Snake eyes.
Yeah, serpent shape.
There you go.
But I mean, I think even the shape that Ralph, put them in is really nice and unique, because normally these sort of structures are just engineered in straight lines. And I mean, obviously, that's exactly what we don't want to do with this sort of infrastructure.
And there's no particular reason why it has to be that to get your effect, surely. It doesn't have to be straight, it can be curved.
No, the basic geometry is associated with it being loosely parallel to shore.
Right.
And an effective distance offshore. So it's not not too close and yet not too far to be ineffective in reducing wave height.
Becky, tell me about your project here, the academic interest here.
Yeah, so a lot of the work in our lab looks at how we can integrate engineering with ecology. Mm-hmm. So we look at how we can design these types of structures so that they work from both the wave attenuation perspective but also provide habitat for species. And a lot of our species of focus has been shellfish because, like Ralph said, the shellfish globally have experienced an 85% loss. Our native Australia Angazi, the flat oyster in Port Phillip Bay, less than 1% remains now.
Nobody talks about that.
No, it is lost in the memories of Australians, unfortunately. So, yeah, with European colonisation, there was mass destruction of oyster reefs. We know that Indigenous Australians used them for tens of thousands of years before through the shell middens, and within 50 years they were gone. So effectively lost from our living memory.
So is there a plan to repopulate this area actively, or is it just left a natural process?
So part of our research, so there's a student, another postdoc in the lab working on this reef as well. So we're actually actively seeding this reef with both mussels and oysters. Ah. So we have the mussels already on the reef. We can see, so there's some patches on some of the modules, and we should get oysters in the next few weeks or so.
Then you've got to convince people to keep their cotton picking hands off them, I guess.
Yes. I guess it would be nice if in, X number of years' time, we have a nice self-sustaining shellfish population on these reefs, and then potentially that we would get other ecosystem services like water filtration and all the biodiversity benefits that shellfish reefs provide, but potentially sustainable harvesting as well. Until then, we would like them to stay put on the reef to be able to establish that population. We're testing different heights, we're putting them in different microhabitats to look at where they survive best on these, so that we can inform future projects about how to design them best for shellfish.
And what's your sense of it so far? How well is it going?
So the mussels we've been put on have only been on for about a month now, and there's quite a few surviving.
Can you show me?
Yes, there's some over here. this one would have had a few. But on here.
Okay.
So with the mussels.
So just describe the technique there.
So with the mussels, they can actually. So all shellfish, their larvae, when they start floating around in the water, and then they attach to a hard surface and grow. Mussels can actually reattach and attach themselves because they have these little threads that they can grow. They're called byssal threads that they use to attach themselves to the rock. And so we can actually transplant mussels by taking them off something else, putting them onto our modules here, and then just putting a bit of mesh over them for a few weeks,
right,
and then removing that mesh once they've attached. Oysters are a little bit trickier because once they've attached, they can't be moved. They cement to a structure. So with the oysters, what we're actually going to do is epoxy them onto the reef, which would be is obviously quite time consuming and not necessarily scalable, but it's at this point we're testing
sort
methods.
Sort of a proof of concept.
Proof of concept. Yep. And then, ideally we would be looking at seeding at recruitment stage for oysters.
What a great project. Aren't they wonderful shapes?
Yes, they're very complex, and that's the big issue with coastal infrastructure normally is that they're these
lots of
flat
nooks and crannies.
Yes, they look, they contain the nooks, the types of nooks and crannies that you would expect on a natural
shore. They're very sort of science fiction-y. They're like they're from another world.
It's true.
In a good way.
Yeah.
You happy with the way this is shaping up, Alex?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we've been getting a lot of people coming to snorkel, and I think Ralph's girls are probably
we have representatives of the local snorkeling community on hand, actually. let's ask. Hello.
Hi.
So as a snorkeling spot, how does it rate?
It's very, very good. There's a lot of wildlife that is living on the reefs, and it's really cool to see. We shined a torch into the taller ones, into the middle of the cave thing, and there was heaps of little shrimp swimming around. That was really cool.
Because they're really intricate little objects, aren't they?
They're
lots
very,
of lots of spaces there for all the critters to come and go and hide.
Yeah, they're very well designed. Around the bottom of them, we saw a lot of big crabs, which were really cool.
So, despite the fact that it all looks pretty quiet now, once the tide comes in and you're out there, down there underneath with it all, the thing comes to life.
Yeah, it's really good.
Great spot. You need your wetsuit, though.
Yes, it's freezing.
Well, bravo, everybody. What a...
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, it's really, I think great effort by Ralph to get this in. And it was, it's taken quite a few years and there's been a lot of people involved. So
These processes just don't happen, do they?
No, I mean, there's a lot of processes that need to, a lot of boxes that need to be ticked for good reason. I think, marine coastal defence is a pretty conservative area. But I think this is a great step forward with what, potentially could be done in the future.
And Council Ralph, all around it, they were sort of, did it take convincing, or what was the long tail there? How long has it taken through the council to get this happening?
Council are very supportive of protecting our coast.
Yeah.
They're also, I think... The point of difference with a lot of other organisations are that they really encourage innovation, and sometimes that can come with a risk. But I think engaged, the right people, such as Alex and the Reef Design Lab, to come up with a product that we're really proud of and has been very well accepted by the community. And the big add-on is the research that the University of Melbourne are undertaking. It really validates what we're trying to achieve here. Can I also add that the City of Greater Geelong really promotes sustainable use of materials, and in this case we've used
recycle shell from a local shell grit processing plant to be used as the aggregate instead of just using crushed rock. And as well as Alex went to the next step of sourcing a byproduct called fly ash that we used, that he used instead of cement. It's a great reduction in the energy used to produce standard cement product, and fly ash is a byproduct that is quite readily available.
Well, that's pretty cool development too. I love the idea of the shell as aggregate.
Yeah, and you can actually see a great example of it just here. So,
Okay. All right. Yes.
You know, we had the surface of these units sandblasted by the precaster we work with,
yep.
And you know, this has been great because you can see it sort of opens up all these pores in the shell and creates another great sort of crevice for whatever's colonizing to take hold. You know, potentially oysters and mussels. Mm. So,
did you design the shapes?
Yeah. I'm responsible for that. Yeah.
Oh, they're quite beautiful. They seem so man-made, and yet there's something organic about them. They're like a cross-section of some sort of a creature.
Yeah, and I think that's right. We're not trying to, you know, kind of replicate a reef, the shape of what you would naturally have down here, where we're not trying to sort of fake
it
and create.
It's art.
Well, exactly. I think that's what's kind of important. You know, we don't want to try to pretend that they're not man-made. They are, but I think the way that we've designed it certainly is sympathetic to the environment, and you can see that by how quickly it's being colonized and how quickly it's starting to look really natural.
It's like a sort of a Barcelona reef. It's
yeah, got absolutely.
Organic structure idea about it.
That is a great compliment.
Oh, congratulations to everybody. What an inspiring project.
Yeah, no, thanks so much.
What's next?
I mean, look, hopefully more of these kind of reefs. Hopefully, you know, more councils can take it up and follow the great example that the City of Greater Geelong have, done with this project. And, I think the future's hopefully quite bright in the area of coastal defence.
Coastal defence. That's a good expression.
I mean, you can kind of see as well, you know, exactly how the modules are working with, you know, this very small wave energy that's coming through.
Yeah.
And, you know, how much calmer it is on this side.
On the other side, yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, we're able to achieve that still with a highly porous structure, which is...
Water can flow through these is the point, although it breaks the wave pattern.
And that's still kind of, that's important for the ecology as well, Becky?
Yes. Yeah, so I think the porosity of these structures would have contributed a lot to the wave attenuation potential, but also, the porosity increases the habitat surface area, all of the different types of microhabitats present in these structures, just to provide greater areas for colonization.
Very cool. And I managed to come out and see it without falling flat on my face in the water and destroying
my gear. You still got to get back in.
Still time.
Tide's coming up.
All right.
Thank you.
See
you.
And that was industrial designer Alex Goad from Reef Design Lab, coastal engineer Ralph Rube from Geelong City Council, and Ralph's daughter, 13-year-old Virginia Lee Rube. Becky Morris was there too from the University of Melbourne. Now I'm going to turn around and fighting the incoming tide, wade my way home. Is an internationally acclaimed leading Australian garden designer, and these are his Garden Rudimentals, a blueprint series on the basics of garden craft. The sound of the exquisite outdoors, which is where I find Paul Bangay. Hello.
Jonathan.
Paul and I, we chat once a month on things garden and rudimental, and if you missed any of those conversations, and there's a year and a bit of them now.
That long already?
Yes.
Wow.
You'll find them on the ABC Listen app. But Paul, we began last time, we were talking inspiration last time.
Yeah.
Which is a fine thing to find in a garden.
Yes.
And well, to inspire the thing itself. And one great source, I mean, you're perhaps Australia's best known garden designer.
Hopefully.
Debatable.
But there have been others before you.
Yes. And I think that for me, I got great inspiration as a child and still do from books. You know, one of my greatest escapes as a child was going down to the local library and borrowing books on gardens.
What's your first garden book?
Well, I think my first garden book was Gertrude Jekyll's Woodland Garden. And I just thought it was magical going into the world of Gertrude Jekyll. And our local library, Nutter Wadding Library, very well stocked. They must have had a great gardener down there as the librarian. Very well stocked with good gardening books.
What great good fortune.
Yeah, no, I was very, 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 very lucky, wasn't I?
Her woodland? Tell me about that.
So Gertrude Jekyll was a really well-known English garden designer who worked closely with Edward Lutyens. And she actually discovered Lutyens. She gave Lutyens one of his first sort of commissions. And they worked very closely together. And she wrote about, I don't know, eight to ten books on garden design, specifically on garden design. And she taught herself about garden design. She was myopic. She could hardly see. And she saw colour in a very blurry way.
Wow.
And that's how she designed her flower borders. Like, she didn't see individual colours. The colours actually merged together, which gave her this lovely sort of feeling to a flower border. Isn't that incredible?
That's an extraordinary thing. And as for the person without that myopia,
yeah,
how do they look? What I mean, that's still that sense of
her herbaceous borders were copied laboriously for up until today. I mean, she was the mother of herbaceous borders, really.
I want that on my tombstone.
What? The mother of all herbaceous borders.
What's her period? When are we talking about?
So she was the early 20th century.
And is that a turning point in garden design? I mean, modernity occurs, possibly the size of land that people are wanting to make gardens in is maybe getting a bit smaller.
I think so. I guess up until that time, we only thought about gardens as the sort of large estates. Hers were slightly more domestic in scale. You know, they were still country gardens, but they did come down in scale quite a bit. And I think more importantly, the books that she wrote were very taken up by home gardeners and were easily sort of translated to a smaller domestic scale.
Is there a moment too when garden design becomes something of a specialty? I imagine at that time and maybe 19th century, I mean, people, you know, would take their own cuttings. They would make their own sort of constructions in garden. I mean, it was a skill that was perhaps a bit closer to people's consciousness in those times than it maybe is now.
I think so. Yes, I think, when did it become an actual profession? A thing. I mean, we go right back into Capability Brown, and before Capability Brown, they were very highly regarded landscape designers. So, you know, garden design had been around for quite a long time.
That's interesting, though. You've just jumped in expression from garden design to landscape design.
Yes, well,
and that when I think Capability Brown, I think that big sweeping vision.
Well, and I think that's where you're absolutely right. I think they were all about the landscape. Gertrude Jekyll was really more about the garden. And then, of course, we went to William Robinson, who was the wild gardener. And so he sort of elaborated a bit more on Gertrude Jekyll's designs and created sort of a wilder, more naturalistic garden that we're following today, really.
What sort of stuff did he like? What were his favourites?
He liked letting trees, you know, and very much a precursor to our Edna Walling, like, you know, scatters of silver birch trees with lovely sort of molossus azaleas underneath them. Very loose, very casual.
heather, like, you know, instead of heather being out in the fields, he brought heather into the garden and sort of drifts of heather underneath silver birch trees.
Was it you who told me that in the Walling thing about locating her birches by
tossing potatoes over her? Well, because we spoke about this.
Over her
doing
shoulder,
something random is one of the hardest things in the world to do.
Yes.
If you actually go put stakes where you want trees to look random, there's some sort of pattern that always reoccurs. And so she got over this by just throwing potatoes over her shoulder.
I wonder if you ever cheated, you know, no, I don't like the way they've fallen, no, I'm going
to
move
that, that one's a little bit too close to the other one.
All right, that's interesting. So we have this idea of wildness, and that's, I'm trying to, this is probably a hopeless quest, but I'm wondering if there is a matching of broader history and movement of socially with what's happening in the garden, and that wildness thing seems to be occurring in that sort of strange time of the 20s and 30s when, you know, the world thinks it's been traumatized and is acting out a bit. It's a looser place.
Well, but funny enough, they often say when there's a lot of money around, when the economy is really booming, we hark back to traditional times.
Mm-hmm.
We hark back to classicism. So we go back, you think of the 1980s, very much a reproduction of classical architecture again. You know, the whole of Australia was filled with mock Georgian houses back then. And then when harder times come, we seem to be going towards more casual, more free, and more relaxed sort of styles. So I think that's probably the social comment there. Do you think?
Yeah, well, garden design is one of the things which does change with the times.
It does.
It definitely has its patterns and trends.
And I think it is tied up with climate as well. I mean, we've got to think that we're very worried about the changing climate and sort of very traditional large lawns that need a lot of water, lots of hedges that needs a lot of clipping, a lot of work.
Yep.
You know, labour costs are high. We're worried about the water usage. So, you know, that sort of wilder garden, freer garden doesn't need as much labour. Doesn't need as much energy, doesn't need as much water.
What would be your sort of reading list? You discovered one as a lad.
Yes. Russell Page's Education of a Gardener. If anyone is an aspiring landscape designer or even a home garden designer, they have to get Russell Page's Education of a Gardener.
His story?
So he's my greatest hero of all time. So he was sort of operating in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, maybe a little bit earlier than that. And his gardens, he is the king of proportion and scale. Like, he just got it all completely right. He worked for the Agnelli family. He worked for all those wonderful sort of industrialist Italian families. Worked in England, worked in America, did the Pepsi Cola headquarters outside New York. Like, he's just a master of garden design. But his book, The Education of a Gardener, is all writing. There's not much photography in there. And it's just fascinating reading. If anyone wants to really get a good grounding for landscape design, it's that book.
What's his basic thought? Does he have a guiding theory?
No, not really. I mean, he tries to teach a scale, and he taught me that don't be afraid of large scale. Like, don't underscale things. Always try and overscale things. And I think that's stuck in my mind.
Give me an example of that.
Well, you know, don't make your garden beds too narrow. Always make them generous. Okay. Make them deep. You know, if you're going to do a pergola, make it taller than what you think it should be. If you're going to do a pot and a terrace, let's do it 50% bigger than what your initial thought was, and it'll probably look better.
Why does that work, I wonder?
Because we instinctively want to underscale things. I don't know why, but we do.
All right. Got scale sorted. what do I read next?
So then, you know, I think all the Edna Walling books are pretty fabulous. Edna Walling did quite a few books, and I think reading all her books certainly taught me quite a lot. And I think her take on Australian garden design was pretty amazing. And funny, she ended up by writing books on the weeds that grow on the side of roads. so she's ended up where we've all ended up, where we love it. We're in love with weeds.
Well, is that a natural progression? It may be. I mean, it's funny how the things sort of go hand in hand a bit. People like writing about gardens. It's they're twin skills.
Yeah, and they're a hard thing to write about too. Mm.
That itself takes a fair bit of ability to conjure that.
I think it does. I mean, I think a lot of us instinctively know what we want to do in the garden, but then articulating it that and writing it down is often quite difficult.
You've done a few of your own.
I've done a few of my own books, but quite often I struggle with that.
So after Edna Walling?
I think that, you know, if we go, then there was a wonderful book called Visions of Paradise that came out in the 1980s, and that was the start of that big explosion of garden photography books. You know, we sort of, was very much, the books before that were about sort of words and black and white photographs. All of a sudden we had the explosion of wonderful big full-page colour photographs of wonderful big international gardens, and Visions of Paradise was the first book of that sort of genre.
But we won't even mention sort of what the Instagram period has done for
that there. I mean, funny enough, books are coming back again. Mm. Like when I first started publishing books, they were very popular. Then, you know, book sales went down, and now they're going back up again. It's amazing in the era of Instagram.
It's a tricky thing, though. I mean, the beautifully curated, perfectly lit, much laboured over garden photograph.
Yeah,
it can be an intimidating thing. You know, it is what you might do as a source of, you know, taking that as a source of inspiration. Will it ever be that good?
That's an interesting thought. I mean, quite often people come and visit our garden. I know when I go visit gardens, other people's gardens, and they all look so beautiful and they all look so perfect. Mm. Is that intimidating? I don't think it is. I think what people take away from that and from those big photographies is maybe just little parts of it. You know, gardeners are good at looking at that and going, actually, I like that two combinations of plants
those
there.
Those things there, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
You know, it's not the big broad picture. It's more the detail in there that they seem to take away.
So, and they're moving, we're kind of moving now into our current period. And you've done all this without mentioning Vita Sackville-West.
I know.
I'm impressed by that.
Do I overplay Vita Sackville-West?
Well, not necessarily.
I mean, you know, Sissinghurst, we've spoken about Sissinghurst many times and the great effect that has on people. And her writings, you know, are just so, she writes about gardens so beautifully. Mm. And funny enough, I mean, she you know, she's a great novelist and a great poet. But her greatest achievements, she says, were the writings she used to do for one of the magazines in England or one of the newspapers in England. And she used to write about her garden.
A garden column. Okay.
A garden column. Was a garden column. And she used to write, and people used to write to her, and then she'd write back and tell them what to do in the garden. And I've got quite a few of those letters. I've been collecting them.
Paul, thank you. That's a nice little cook's tour through. There's a nice potted reading history there. And we want to finish, as we've been doing this year, with a quote from your The Gardener Says book.
Yes.
Go on.
To forget how to dig the earth and tend the soil is to forget ourselves.
Who said that?
Mahatma Gandhi. Isn't that fabulous? And I think that is, so many people are scared to put their hands in the soil. Why is that? Because I think that's one of the greatest calming things that I can do, is getting down the vegetable garden, getting my hands dirty.
It's a wonderful, I almost resent the times that I need to put gloves on.
Yeah, I resist gloves greatly.
Yeah.
I know we're supposed to wear gloves.
To our detriment, probably.
Probably to our detriment. I've never been sick from putting my hands in the soil, have you?
Not that I'm aware of, the occasional cut or scrape, but, you know.
It does you good.
It is a one. Well, we are with Gandhi. We're in a unity ticket here.
Exactly.
Paul, thank you.
Pleasure.
So we hear a lot about natural disaster, flood, bushfire, earthquakes, and the conversation in the aftermath of those events is often about recovery. And then it potentially segues into notions of mitigation. An interesting paper recently published in the International Journal of Disaster Risk Reduction is about resilience in the face of disaster, and it looked at ways in which authorities, owners of property, came together to retrofit masonry buildings in response to heightened risks of aftershocks after earthquakes in the US and New Zealand.
One of the authors of that paper is Olga Filipova. She's an associate professor at Auckland University's Department of Property. Olga, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm very happy to be here.
The conversation, it's true, is it not, around disaster is increasingly moving towards this notion of mitigation rather than the urgent and desperate need to recover from an incident.
That's true, Jonathan. We do need to look more into resilience, and we need to be prepared for future disasters and not deal with damaged buildings around us. We need to be able to get people back into their properties as fast as possible. And the only way to do it is do the work before the disaster happens.
Yeah, we, in this country, we have just marked an anniversary of some serious flooding in northern New South Wales. And I guess the big takeout from that is how little has been done to give people back their homes, but also a sense of future safety. I wonder if we could look at your experience, and this is in and around the Christchurch earthquakes, and what was done to rehabilitate and make buildings safe in that place. And one of the big things there was retrofitting masonry buildings of brick and mortar. Yep. Tell us why that was necessary.
Well, of course, New Zealand is known for being an earthquake, high seismically active country. And we have had regulations for quite a long time, even before the Christchurch earthquakes, about retrofitting existing buildings, but it wasn't mandatory or enforced at the national level. But of course, the Christchurch earthquakes was a big wake-up call for us to reassess our built environment, and in particular where most fatalities happened or the most damage happened in Christchurch is around unreinforced masonry buildings, which are kind of your early 1900s buildings built with brick.
So basically, and this is just brick walls falling down is the...
Yes, the greatest risk from this building is to the public because the walls tend to fall outside onto the pathways. So it actually, they say that you're safer inside their unreinforced masonry building than you are outside of it.
Hmm.
Yes. So the recent legislation that the country has enacted is to require all of the buildings in the country that fit certain criteria to be assessed and determined whether they're going to be safe or not in an earthquake. And a lot of unreinforced masonry buildings fall into that category of being unsafe.
Right. I mean, I think that's where it's really interesting in terms of broad application, because you had a pre-existing situation where people could voluntarily, but, you know, with information supplied, do the necessary work. But it needed this intervention of legislation. It needed some sort of sense of compulsion to really get the work done.
Yes, definitely. Without the regulatory push, not much work would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And look, in New Zealand, this legislation, we are at the stage where the local governments are still identifying the buildings that are problematic and potentially dangerous in an earthquake. There are some building owners that have already been engaged in retrofits and they've completed their buildings. They're potentially safe now. But still, a lot of buildings still need to be retrofitted. And, you know, for us, a lot of them will not meet the deadlines that the government imposed because a lot of it comes down to the costs of retrofits. You know, we can have all the best signs about the buildings and how they behave in earthquakes, and we know about the dangers, but it ultimately comes down to the cost.
Well, to tell us a bit more about the detail of what has to be done, this notion of retrofitting a masonry building, what's involved?
Well, you have to engage an engineer, first of all, to determine the level of, I guess, earthquake proneness of the building. So what sort of retrofit is required? And then from that, they will engage someone who can estimate the cost and develop a program for the retrofit. But a lot of these unreinforced masonry buildings, because they were built such a long time ago, and there isn't a lot of documentation that, I guess, we can refer to. They're all so unique that the retrofit solutions can vastly vary from building to building, and therefore costs are quite uncertain.
Do you think that the regulatory settings now are such that the necessary work will be done, or does more need to be looked at in a regulatory sense?
I think there should be more support in areas that perhaps economically are not as well off as our bigger centers, where market will push a lot of retrofits. So kind of the incentives need to be structured to give higher support to our regional centers. It has to be a tailored approach to the retrofit programs and not kind of one size fits all.
Does the insurance industry enter into this picture at any point?
Definitely. I mean, insurance company, they do not insure buildings that are earthquake prone. So earthquakes that are potentially going to be, I mean, buildings that are potentially going to be have a significant damage in an earthquake, there is already no insurance for those buildings. And I guess that's one of the drivers for building owners to then, okay, if I want my building to be rebuilt after an earthquake, I better do something.
Do you think that the regulatory model that we're seeing emerge in New Zealand is a thing which other countries could look at? And not just around earthquakes, but around this whole notion of resilience and mitigation in the face of natural disaster. Are there things that New Zealand has learned that could inform other countries' efforts?
I think the policy that we have in New Zealand is good in principle. We're still yet to see how effective it is. As I said, there are a lot of deadlines. Building owners have deadlines to do the retrofits in their buildings. As I said, it all comes down to the cost for them. We can have regulations for everything, but especially when it comes down to building owners, you know, property rights are just strongly, you know, it's just difficult to enforce things on the building owner if that involves investment into retrofits from the building owner.
And not just retrofits, of course. I mean, as we've seen in southern Turkey, the huge earthquakes there and the devastation, and much of that attributed to pre-existing regulatory failure around building standards. So that's the other side of this coin, of course, is enforcing that standard before the disaster occurs.
Yes, of course, it's having the transparency and the oversight of how things are implemented. It's very important. But as you can see, what's been lost in Turkey is a lot of heritage buildings. And I think the same happening in New Zealand, potentially, if we don't provide sufficient support for our building owners who own heritage buildings, which are also very prone to collapse or damage in a disaster, we're going to lose that heritage. And we need to have big conversation in terms of if society values heritage, who is going to be paying for that? And I think government has to play a major role in terms of supporting building owners of heritage buildings if we want to
make sure
that they remain.
Look, it's a very interesting area. I guess the broad lesson is that in the face of natural disaster, some sort of regulatory environment is necessary to make sure that the building blocks are laid to mitigate and create resilience in the long term. We need that regulatory help.
I think regulations are important because they create the initial drive, the push in the kind of along the market, among the market participants. In different areas within the country, as I said, those that are more economically well off, I would say, market will drive. So they would kind of pick up on the regulation and will drive a lot of changes. But tailored support needs to be provided for smaller regional centers that may not have sufficient resources to deal with these problems.
Olga, thank you. Thank you for your research and your time.
No, you're welcome, Jonathan. It was nice talking to you.
Olga Filipova, an associate professor at Auckland University's Department of Property, and that research focusing on improving disaster resilience in the built environment. It's a Blueprint for Living, ABC RN.
I'm now on Blueprint for Living for an icon. And that can mean but one thing. Yes, Colin Bissett.
Mention the name Cesar Pelli and you can almost predict the sort of building you might see. Shiny, sleek and tall. Usually very tall. For decades, Pelli has been a byword for skyscrapers and was even awarded a lifetime achievement by the Council of Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. When he died in 2019, his practice had completed over 100 major projects, many of them dominating the skyline of the major cities of the world. And while they're hard to fault, they can sometimes be hard to love. But does that matter? Pelli was born in the Tucumán region of Argentina, where he studied architecture at the local university and met his future wife, the landscape designer Diana Balmori. In 1952, they emigrated to the US, with Cesar studying at the University of Illinois under the guidance of Eero Saarinen. He later worked with Saarinen on the futuristic TWA flight centre at JFK Airport. There's certainly something of Saarinen's Scandinavian simplicity in Pelli's work, and yet, where Saarinen showed a definite joie de vivre, Pelli's work is more restrained. An early commission was the Pacific Design Centre in West Hollywood, built in 1974 and later extended. Known locally as the Blue Whale, it established Pelli as an architect who wanted to make a statement. The Blue Whale's playful shape and colour had a postmodern feel to it, but Pelli quickly moved into more conventional modernist territory, becoming a master of glazing and translucence. He claimed that it was unimportant to have a signature style, but it was vital that a building responded to its site. His buildings, with their smooth, shiny exteriors, quickly became symbolic of the cool efficiency of commerce in the capitals of the world. Like One Canada Square, the steel-sheathed tower that anchors London's Canary Wharf business district, which rose in the early 1980s and was taller than any in London. Its style matched the towers he designed for the World Financial Centre in Manhattan, thereby unifying the banking worlds of both cities. Later towers, often beautifully glazed with surgical precision, are visually striking, especially when glinting in the morning or evening sunlight, and dominate the skyline of cities from Santiago in Chile to Seville in Spain. The most famous is the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, the tallest in the world for several years after opening in 1998, and built to show that the Asian capital meant business. The idea was interesting. Rather than one massive tower, he created two, linked by a slender sky bridge. They were inspired, he said, by Islamic shapes and Buddhist temples, each rising to over 450 metres, and are covered in such shiny steel that they gleam like sacred objects. They speak not of spirit, of course, but of money. And that's always there in Pelli's work. His buildings have the sober aesthetic of a German luxury car or a well-cut suit, things that work very well but don't always excite, even when muscling everything else out of the way. Pelli wasn't alone in creating this language of the global village, or its financial centres at least, but he was a master of it, creating symbolic little black dresses for the great cities of the world. Sometimes elegant, always refined, and shining every bit as brightly as the piles of money that paid for them.
Colin, thank you. All Colin's icons gathered for you at the ABC Listen app. You'll find all the things we do there for your occasional or constant listening pleasure. We'll be back to talk more Blueprint same time next time. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.